further discussion on Anthropic AI?
It's still there.
When I talk about AI, or the type of AI I'm interested in, I want to relocate it between a few other fields, a few other areas of AI, because my AI is very different from what most people use AI. The most popular type of AI around is machine learning, which is a rather rational or idealized thing. The only thing I would say is more rational and more idealized than that would be logic-based AI, which is in practice very much any longer. But there's another dimension, that is like whether people are interested in technology or people are interested in science. So if people who do cognitive simulation are very interested in the science of what humans actually are, so there's sort of, you have psychologists here and you have marketing people here. Okay, like these people are interested in money and these people are interested in psychology. So my stuff is as human-like as it can get. Oops, how did that happen?
If you touch the screen, it's like
touching. I didn't touch the screen. I just waved near it.
Yeah, near the screen. You breathed on the screen.
Okay, so my stuff is as human-like as it can get. The only thing that's sort of nearly as human-like and nearly as technological as what I'm interested in is chatbots. But chatbots are really not really, they're not really interested in being very human-like. They just want to be human-like enough to fool someone. I'm interested in being more human-like than they are, but they're completely committed to technology. I dare say they're even less committed to psychology than I am. They just want to fool whoever into believing that there's a human on the other side, and they really don't want to be corrected anyway. So I'm a little more scientific than they are, but still in that quadrant.
Can you explain why cognitive simulation is less human-like than chatbots?
Human-like than chatbots. Because a cognitive simulation is aiming to produce sort of like general mechanisms which explain humans the way they are in a full way, while chatbots often just incorporate dirty tricks like typing something and then hitting backspace or pretending to hit backspace in order to give a human-like feel to it. And there's no general theory of why hitting the backspace would be part of what it is to be human. So let's say that this little difference of the height is like they're hitting a backspace type of where
human. Okay, I don't understand. Why wouldn't that argue for the opposite? So they're just using kludges, so they're not really getting at what it is to be human. Whereas you could say the cognitive simulation people are at least aiming to be produce human. Some people are trying to simulate, you know, human psychological processes. So why aren't they? Why isn't science cognitive simulation of humans in the upper right corner? Why isn't it science and human-like? Maybe you need to explain.
We can spend 15 minutes on it, and I don't have that. So if that's the most important question, let's leave it.
Okay, sure.
I'm happy to join again. Come back to this in this day.
So is the reason simply that chatbots are likely to fool, are capable of fooling people into thinking that they're human sometimes, whereas cognitive simulations, scientific simulations, they don't have that property.
Cool. It's been a while since I pretended to be this guy. But that's sort of like locating sort of like far away from science and far away from the rational idea. So it's human-like technology that I'm interested in. Okay. Again, locating within the argument, I'm going to talk about introspection. So, obviously, Watson, who forbade introspection, and Simon, who's his successor, and a very important character, are my antagonists. Simon is a very important character because he's one of the founding fathers of AI and of cognitive psychology and of every discipline in social science other than anthropology. That's a quote from one of his colleagues. Every discipline in social sciences other than anthropology, he's like a huge influence. Okay? The only person to get the Turing Prize and the Nobel Prize. Hugely influential, but a bit historical, so people don't always appreciate how influential he is. They're like Simon's natural enemy was Dreyfus, and I'm also against him. I'm sort of trying to be in the middle. Okay? Now, the motivation why I think we need to look at radical new ways of doing AI is, amongst others, Minsky's comment that AI has been brain dead since the 1970s. So we haven't had any radical new ideas like, let's do neural nets. That's from the 40s and 50s. We haven't had an idea of that size, at least according to Minsky, since the 70s. Okay, a point about philosophy of technology, which to a degree is what I'm doing, and how it differs from philosophy of science. Science is about what is. We find this animal and we want to know what it is. We find this creature. Is it an animal? Is it a plant? Is it a mushroom? What is it? We want to know the true nature of something specific. Well, in technology, we're interested in what is it to be something. Here I'm actually agreeing with Simon. So when we are building in the late 19th century a horseless carriage, we're interested in what does it mean to be a carriage? What does it mean to move people from one place to another? It doesn't require a mane. It doesn't require food, eating food and polluting the streets with feces. The idea of technology, so the focus in technology is what are the necessary functions in order to be something, rather than what is the true nature of a horse or whatever, or a carriage, dissecting it. It's more functional than dissecting. Okay? In technology, we use perspectives all the time. We don't believe in... In science, we aim at least for one truth. One of the things that hurts physics the most is that they have two big theories, relativity and quantum theory, and they're not that compatible. So that really pains them. In technology, we're not interested in one unified truth. When we design a system, we look at it mechanically, and then we look at it electrically, and then we look at it thermally, and then we look at it this way, and then we look at it that way, and we're shifting perspectives all the time. So in terms of truth theory, we're interested in perspectivism. Our view is perspectivist. There are many truths, and that's fine. It's not a problem. People who try to unify all the truths and say, there is one truth, there is only one truth, they usually have some sort of agenda. Historically, it's usually been religion, so it can also be politics, it can also be academically. I have my favorite analysis tool, and that is the truth, and you will all see that my truth is the best one, because I want to keep one. I didn't say that. So, I treat people who believe in one truth with great suspicion from a technology point of view. We need to be able to look at things in different ways. Same thing is about people who say that there are clear layers. Like there's this layer and there's that layer and they're utterly distinct. Well, it's very rare to find any layers that are utterly distinct outside of human inventions, abstract inventions such as law or mathematics.
Could you flesh that out a little bit? Because when you say, oh, there are these people who say that there's this layer and that layer, I have no idea what you're talking about.
If you look at geological layers, even in the most distinct rocks, if you look at it microscopically, they're mixed. There's a little layer where they're mixed.
Okay.
If you want to say, I'm going to say that there is human-like versus ideological, and yes, you can, if you really dig, find a place where these two mix, and it's not that distinct. But I think the distinction is valid, like between human-like and rational, whether you can find a tiny place that's where they mix or not. You don't have, like, the fact that there is, we could bring a counterexample where this counterexample can't be divided according to the layers doesn't even validate the fact of the layer for the other 99%. Okay? So.
I thought you were down on layers.
Yeah.
I'm down on layers. I don't like layers.
But didn't you just.
Let's let him go because he's only got about 15 minutes left.
Sorry.
And he's. Only just finished his preliminary slide,
okay.
So even though I like to jump in too, I'm going to bite my tongue as well.
So, the thesis is going to be that introspection is recommended or has a role to play in Anthropic AI. Recommended is a weak word. It means that it's worth pursuing. It's not a waste of time. It doesn't mean it will always produce good results. It doesn't mean that it will produce good results in more than 50% of the time. It means it will be interesting in enough time that it will be worth spending time on. When I say recommended for, okay, so for means as a basis for something. Okay, so we look at that in a minute together with developing in the next slide. Okay, there are 5 minds involved in an AI development process. If anyone can find another one, I'd be happy to find out about it. So there's the practitioner sitting in their office, all kinds of very important AI people here. They're sitting in their office and they're thinking about the way a certain mind works, or a certain information processing system works. It could be neural nets, or it could be insects, or it could be some set theory, or some other mathematics, or it could be introspection. The only image in the world I found in introspection, it could be like the structure of the human body, or whatever inspiration they use, or basis they use, they look at it. So these are 2 minds, or part minds, or information processing entities, and they build their AI system on that basis. So there's sort of 3 which are very clear. But then there are observers from the outside, philosophers that have things to say, like Dreyfus would definitely live here. And then there's the most important mind that's usually not in the room and not really that interested, but the person who decides whether there's any funding. So DARPA is here. And they think that this sort of AI is important and that one isn't. And they have actually the most influence that on the process overall. So there's 5 different minds. So when we say recommended for, I'm recommending that the practitioner practice introspection as his basis. Okay, so I'm not recommending that the robot practice introspection. I think that would be a really good idea for 10, 20 years down the road. I'm recommending that the practitioner practice introspection as his basis for AI. So that's developing. So we're recommending it. Yeah, that's sort of. So I'm left with, in the thesis, introspection is recommended for anthropic AI. I'm left with anthropic AI. I need to explain that introspection that I need to explain. So let's start with that. Anthropic AI. Okay, so we've discussed human-like versus ideal rational. Some people find that distinction a bit odd and sort of half deny that there is human-like AI, because our favorite textbook where this distinction comes from. Our favorite textbook, Russell and Norvig, which is used in 1,300 schools in over 100 countries, so it's become a complete monoculture, and the vast majority of people who get educated in AI use that textbook, and that textbook introduces this distinction in the introduction that nobody reads, and after it introduces this distinction between human-likes and rational, it says, and the rest of this volume is dedicated to rational agents. Bang. So human-like AI isn't taught in the introductory course to AI at all. It's ignored. So that's why people have problems with that. So human-like is a good idea because it is more general than logical or idealized AI. Because who invented whom? Who invented logic? Humans invented logic. Has logic invented humans yet? No. So by logic, humans are more general than logic. Okay? So it's more general. Human-like AI would be useful for getting along with people. If we want to have care for the elderly, or I'm hesitant to say this, but we still don't have driverless cars. If we want driverless cars that actually understand the local driving culture in different places, then we need something that actually is more human-like in its operation. So there are reasons to want human-like AI, mainly for interaction with humans. So in a sense, this whole field could be seen as part of human-computer interaction. Okay. And when I say anthropic as distinct from human-like, I mean unenculturated. So the human condition does not require, for something to be human, it doesn't need to be Western. It doesn't need to be modern. It doesn't need to be well-trained in anything, including maths or just being rational or all these Western modern notions. And it doesn't have to be a grown-up. Okay? So I'm looking for human-level AI, which is sort of supports the culture, but isn't biased towards any particular culture. So the reason I use the word anthropic for unenculturated human-like AI is because I want to use the Greek word anthropos for human. And there's a nice thing in the history of anthropology that before the post-colonial critique came along, sociology was about white people, and anthropology was about black people. And I want this sort of prejudice to resonate when people say anthropic. Yeah, I'm talking about real humans. I'm not talking about right, whatever, male, correct things. Now, there have been some starts in that direction in AI, like psych, where they were trying to teach an expert system common sense, like non-grown-up common sense, like starting from the bottom, and COG, where they're trying to socially teach a robot how to be a Western modern, well-trained grown-up. But they were recognizing that there's something below that needs to be taught. So this is not the first time that anyone points this out. Okay, just as a stepping stone from anthropic to introspection, subjectivity. Humans, as a matter of fact, this is like Anil Seth's favorite line, as a matter of fact, humans all report having subjectivity. So I think it's worth dealing with. People don't like dealing with subjectivity because there's no one truth about it, so it's not very scientific or not very the correct way of doing things. Which is a social fact that people don't like discussing subjectivity. It's been legislated against by Watson, and we'll go into that in great detail in a minute. But why should we do subjective or subjective-inspired AI? First, because it hasn't been done that often before, so it's new, so maybe if we're looking for new ideas for this brain-dead discipline, we should look there. So just let's try something else. Conversational instructions. We often ask people, how would you go about doing something? And we ask for a report, how would you go about doing something? These are just not just forms of speech. They exist in all languages, in at least many languages. And that's how we actually interact with each other. And also having an AI that has something which resembles our subjectivity makes it much easier to debug. That's why debugging classic AI is so much easier than debugging a neural net. If you have a neural net, you have a population of so many thousand neurons, and which one do we need to tweak to make the system work? We don't know. But if we have an expert system, we can say, how come it didn't apply this law, this rule, like number 74, here it is. Oh, there's a typo, okay, fine. We can debug it, okay? So subjective type AI sort of promises to be easier, to be like classic AI in terms of debugging. Okay? It's also making more sense to non-scientists. There are some starts in science about discussing subjectivity, Zoltan here wrote a paper about how we catch a ball by keeping a constant angle to the ball, so that's sort of done from a subjective point of view. But also, every video camera is an artifact with subjectivity because it's located where it is, so it has its own perspective. But that's sort of the same type of subjectivity as what Zoltan was talking about. It's just an angle of perspective, an angle of vision, very literally. But also learning system. Every learning system has learned just what it's learned, and therefore it has the knowledge that it has and not the knowledge someone else has. So subjectivity is can be attacked again from many places, and the one thing I'm really trying to object here is to someone saying, oh, subjectivity, I've done that, tick, and move on. Subjectivity is sort of a quest, something that you need to deal with. So one thing that we do is we do mental self-observation. We observe our own subjectivity. And that's the definition of introspection. So let's look at a couple of definitions of introspection. The first is an observation and sometimes a description of the contents of one's own consciousness. And the second one is sort of like a characterization where there's three mandatory ones and three optional ones, and there's a long discussion behind this thing, but basically it says introspection has to be about mental events, processes, moods, whatever, okay? And you can choose whichever you want, okay? It has to be in the first person, you can't introspect someone else. And it has to be done in temporal proximity. Otherwise, you're dealing with your memories of or something else. It's not introspection, it's reportage about stuff long ago. Okay. Optionally, it has to be direct with no inferences. It has to deal with a pre-existing mental state. The idea is that sort of like split into two, and we're sort of observing the mental state as it was before, but we're describing it from up here. So it's a bit problematic from a logical point of view, but we'll come back to that. And it should involve a minimal amount of effort. So like you're not introspecting all the time. Sometimes you're just doing things without giving a report either to yourself or to others. Okay, so these are the definitions. But there's some strange stuff going on with introspection. The person who prohibited introspection in 1913 is Watson. And he forbade it in 1913, and yet in 1920, while he's still fighting the good war against introspection and the introspective and they're all very evil, he introduces this thing called thinking aloud, which is somehow allowed. That's okay. And what is thinking aloud? It's sort of like letting your thoughts leak out of your mouth as you're doing something. So his classical example is, his friend comes to visit, and there's this contraption in the corridor, and he asks him to figure out what it is. And they discuss it over a few days, and he's sort of thinking aloud, and eventually he finds out what it was about. Okay? So it seems that for Watson and Simon, after Simon and Erickson and Simon wrote a book in several editions called Mental Reports as Data, which is basically about thinking aloud. So it's a very much a respectable technique in cognitive psychology. And so this thinking aloud is very real, and yet it's constantly they're trying to distinguish it from introspection. And it seems that the main two distinctions that they're making is they don't want psychologists doing introspection and giving a verbal report and using that as data. They don't want someone's theory about how they're working. They want the actual data. So they want someone from the street to come in and try and solve a puzzle and speak while they're doing it. That's one distinction that they seem to push very strongly. And the other one is they want the description, the words that are coming out of the person's mouth, to not be about the mechanism, but to be about the content. Not say, oh, I'm using my long-term memory to recall that such and such, whatever. No, I'm this piece here, it seems to twist only so far. It has to be about the content of the problem. And then they will theorize as psychologists. So that's what they seem to want. Okay? So they want the direct, non-inferential, non-polluted observation. But if we go back to the previous definition of what introspection is, according to Schwitz-Gebel, direct, no inferences. So it seems that this definition can sort of work for Watson's thinking aloud, or conversely, the difference between thinking aloud and introspection, the bad, evil introspection that Watson is talking about, is right here about the direct no inferences bit. It seems that these people who are fans of introspection want direct and no inferences. So if you remove the word introspection for a moment, they want a process that is direct and no inferences. And Watson also wants something which is direct and non-inferential, and he calls it thinking aloud. So it would seem that we could just get rid of the word introspection and introduce some new clean vocabulary and solve the problem, and peace will break out. If it were possible. But it isn't possible. What they want, what they both want, is direct, non-inferential, non-polluted observation. Mental observation. But if we look at philosophy of science for a moment, Kuhn, Feyerabend, and others from the 20th century show that there's no such thing, even in describing objects, to say to do something which is non-inferential. Because if I'm trying to describe this thing, what's salient about it is that it's a table, right? We agree about that. But observant Jew on Passover time could say, well, what's salient about this is that there might be some crumbs of bread in here and it's not allowed. That's the salient thing about it. It hasn't been cleaned yet. Or whatever. Like, what is salient? What is the first thing to report about something? It's wooden. Let's say that we have some sort of horrible wood infestation in the building and we're trying to remove all wood. The salient thing about this is that it's wooden, not that it's a table. So the salience is context dependent. Whenever you report, you have to look at some context and draw some inference about what's salient. Also, conceptual frameworks are a problem. In different languages, we divide the color spectrum, for example, differently. And so what we would call pink, languages might split into two, or might be inseparable from red, or whatever. So we're using our system, our conceptual system, to do the description. Using a conceptual system to do the description is inferential. So we can't. So this solution is beautiful, only it doesn't work. It can't exist. Also, there's the famous experiment about the playing cards with the black hearts that were presented to people, and they observed the card along, and the card taken away. And what type was the card? It was hearts. What color was the heart? Red, of course. Okay, because people have top-down, they sort of impose their own view on things. So there's no such thing as a neutral observation. So my beautiful solution to the introspection thing isn't working. But not only is my solution not working, also thinking aloud doesn't work, introspection doesn't work. And basically, if we're going to demand non-inferential, then we need to shut up. We can't do it. A funny thing is that in Watson's example of thinking aloud, he has this contraption. This guy is trying to figure out what this contraption is for. And at some stage, because it took several days, he said, oh, I saw that infernal thing again. Well, obviously, he used infernal because he wanted to use a more stronger expletive, but then he decided not to, maybe because Watson is disrespectful. Scientist, maybe actually he did use a worse word, but then Watson toned it down for his publication. Nobody uses infernal without being inferential or polluted by their manners, because infernal is a strong word used in a respectable way. So we haven't seemed to escape the fact that introspection is bad or polluted inherently. Okay, so we're talking about the horrible introspection. We haven't managed to de-horribilize introspection. Okay, but I will say that horrible introspection is legitimate. Okay, some people will say that introspection is impossible because it requires the mind to split into two and whatever. But people do introspect, so I'm going to leave that without too much of an argument. The main people who object to introspection are Watson, etc. And in science, in philosophy of science, we have a distinction between the context of discovery and the context of the justification. Newton can have an idea while observing a falling apple. Some chemist whose name I can never pronounce can have an idea about the structure of the benzene molecule by dreaming about snakes eating their tail. Now, a snake eating their tail is not the scientific theory of chemistry. But that's just the idea, that's just the discovery. They can justify it in a scientific manner. So basically, in science, we're allowed to have whatever basis or inspiration we want for ideas, so there's nothing wrong with that. And we've already said that in technology, we're less attached to a unified, strict truth. Our criteria, it doesn't work. So this prohibition on introspection, why should only psychology and AI have restrictions on where their ideas come from, and other sciences like chemistry don't? So I don't buy that. Okay. Some people will say that introspection is commonplace in AI, and there's some evidence for it. but they sometimes always they often try to hide it. Often you don't find introspection in the research paper, but you find it in the autobiography. It's not legitimate.
Sorry, isn't that exactly what you would expect if you're using it in the context of discovery, but not in the context of justification? Because it seems that in a research proposal or a research paper, you want to give the scientific justification. In the autobiography, you want to give the discovery context.
There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not against it. I'm against the hiding of it, because there are cases where we can where there are entire books about the source of the idea, the basis of the idea, and so on, and introspection is never mentioned, and only as another person later said, "Oh, I was in the lab with him, and of course he was introspecting." So people are hiding their introspection. People are being shy. Okay, that's the only point I'm making here. People are being shy, and they shouldn't be. Okay, maybe we can get better technology by being less shy. Okay, some people will say that introspection is desirable, but they very seldom produce any code. Okay, and I'm going to, if I have time, I'll make an argument that introspection is unavoidable, that we're all introspecting whenever we're doing AI, but that's very speculative, so we'll do that in the next slide, if at all. Now then there's the next position, which is, yeah, there's nothing new here. Of course, we use introspection in the context of discovery, but we don't use it in the context of justification. And I say, again, why so shy? Why not talk about it? Other scientists talk about it. Why don't we do it in AI? Because there is a prohibition on introspection that goes back to over 100 years and not very well founded. And so that's why I'm sort of trying to release. I'm trying to release that prohibition. Okay, so far I've said introspection is legitimate. Why do I think it's recommended? And that's the last slide. First, it's sort of a logical point of view. You'll forgive me using logic after I spoke against it. If you're trying to create an artificial X, then legislating against certain aspects of X wouldn't necessarily be a good idea. If someone's trying to create artificial leather, they should hold some leather in their hand and look at all the aspects of leather. And if we're trying to create artificial intelligence, but we're not allowed to look at subjectivity or the fact that people report having consciousness or the contents of that consciousness, which would be introspection, that's just odd. If you're trying to create artificial X as technology, then there's no reason to not allow it. Okay, so it would be recommended to hold a piece of leather in your hand if you're trying to create artificial leather. So that's a general point. Now, when we come to teaching skills, if someone teaches me how to ride a bicycle, if I want to teach someone else how to ride a bicycle, I would take a bicycle, go into the park, take helmets, everything, and I'll go to the park and I'll take the bicycle and I'll try to get on the bike, and I will notice that I take the bike and I shift it a little towards me. So it's a little bit in the angle, so when I get my leg over and I hit the pedal, I don't fall the other way. So there's sort of a self-observation. I notice that I'm doing this, and I say, oh, why am I doing this? Oh, I'm doing it to avoid that. And then I tell that to the student, and they get to understand that you need to do that. So I'm observing myself doing physical motion in order to teach a skill. So teaching skills requires self-observation. Unless you're going to remember exactly the words that you were taught with, you're going to parrot the exact words from what you were taught, you have to observe yourself doing something. So that's self-observation. If you're going to teach a mental trick, then you're going to have to do mental self-observation. Like, if someone is, and I'm purposely not going to use something concrete, I'm going to use something more emotional, because all my examples so far have been too common. Someone is stressed out, someone is fearful about some event in the future. And I could teach them the mental skill of, okay, let's consider what happens if you get caught doing X? What's the worst sanction? What's the worst humiliation? What's the worst? And then once you think about it and you've dealt with the possible worst consequences mentally, then you can be a little more relaxed in the present. So this is a teaching someone how to relax themselves in a stressful situation. Okay? Now, I either observe how I do it when I'm teaching that, or I'm parroting the exact words that I was taught. And I argue that it's a more immediate and more reasonable to think that what we're doing is mental self-observation, the same way we do self-observation when we're teaching how to ride a bike. Okay? And if I'll be allowed 2-3 more minutes.
Well, we have to leave the room in 10 minutes, so.
Okay, so let's have a discussion. I don't mean this argument. I don't mean the speculative argument, so let's have a discussion.
Okay, thanks.
Just probably a small point, but you drew a dichotomy between self-observation and parroting the exact words that you were taught. It seems to me that Hume is very good at gist-based remembering. So instead,
you said
between parroting the exact words someone used to teach you basically,
right,
and observing how you do a skill. But I think there might be a sort of third way, which is not parroting the exact words that someone has told you, but essentially just rehashing the gist of what you've been taught. And I think if you look at...
Rehashing the gist through memory, or rehashing the gist
through memory?
Through a photocopy of the gist as it was there before you even practiced it. So we've got every time I learn a skill, I get the gist of it, and I take a photocopy of the gist.
No, he means the gist of what
I put it in memory, and then I use the other one to actually learn the skill. Is that what you're saying?
So what I'm saying is, you get taught a skill, and you get better at it through practice. But as you say, you have this historical account of how you learn the skill in the first place, how you were introduced to it. And if you can remember the gist of how it was introduced to you, where
right,
by when, then I think you find that quite a lot of misconceptions about how skills actually work get repeated through that process.
Right.
Whereas you would expect, if it was an observation-based process, that you wouldn't see things that are just plain wrong about skills being repeated in a teaching context over and over again. Yeah, so things like how do you hit a forehand with tennis? Pretty much everyone teaching you to hit a forehand will tell you as you hit the ball, you roll your wrist over, right? If you do that at a professional level, then you're going to injure your wrist because it happens too fast. The actual rollover comes on the follow through, like after the ball is left. And that's something you pick up through practice, but nevertheless, the wrong version gets repeated over and over again in the teaching context. And I don't think you expect that to happen if every time there was a teaching event, it was somebody observing themselves afresh without these...
So you say there is an element of parroting.
Yeah, just
parroting
of teaching, but yes.
There's another borderline case, that is reading. We teach reading as like, letter after letter after letter after letter, and I have plenty of evidence that skilled readers, don't read that one. So, but when things break down, when and you really want to understand this very difficult word or this foreign word, you do fall back to primitive reading. So there are some skills like skilled reading that you can't communicate, but you can communicate the baseline skill of reading carefully, and then that way you sort of indirectly teach the upper skill. Okay. But consider the person who invented writing, invented the alphabet. They invented something, and then they said, well, if you do ah every time you see this, and you're bleh every time you see this, and so on, then you can put these markings on the clay. And then we can come back a month later and can say the same word again, or we can send this piece of clay to someone else who knows the trick, and it works. So yeah, there is some sort of self-observation going on in teaching the baseline skill. But there is a sort of like fluent skill which comes later. And in reading, that's very clear. But what you're saying is that there is parroting. What you're saying is that don't discount parroting. Parroting is going on, for example, in tennis.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
except parents don't get it.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Y get just.
Yeah,
Peritone's not a good word for
it.
No, but you're saying that they use the word wrist when the actual skill they want is not in the wrist, it's further up the arm.
Yeah, well.
So they repeat that word. They repeat the word wrist when it's not the right word.
Okay.
But they're talking about a particular type of motion that involves that, you know, we can say the words, you know, it's flexing the wrist like this, or it's rotating the wrist, or you're turning your wrist as you hit the ball. There's all kinds of different ways of saying it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't repeat the exact words that somebody uses.
No, that's why
you
said wrist.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So
that's why parrot's not a good word.
Yeah, that's why parrot is not a good word, because it's the gist. The meaning is parroted, not the
meaning
words.
Meaning is parroted. That's interesting. Actually, I struggle to think how you would twist your wrist without twisting your bones further up. But that's a different piece of
another example if you want, which is that you know, when you talk to the bat in cricket, you're always told to keep your eye on the ball.
Mm.
And it turns out that cricketers don't do that. They, in fact, estimate whether the ball is going to bounce and then shift their eyes to where it actually bounces, and they use that calculation to.
This is actually a classical example. Watson, in 1920 paper, says the golfer says he keeps his eye on the ball at all times, and yet the cinema camera or the photo camera, it's different versions, shows that he's lying, essentially. And keep your eye on the ball seems to have become a fixed expression in English, which doesn't mean literally keep your eye on the ball.
There's a view of language that it, especially in these kinds of cases where you shouldn't, the meaning is how does it guide action? And you might think that keep your eye on the ball, the way it guides action is, well, you look at, well, you're, so like you say, literally, I keep my eye on the ball, keep looking at the ball. But no, it's just a way of nudging you in a particular way to attend to this kind of thing or focus on this part of the task. It doesn't necessarily mean that. I think a lot of skill teaching involves manipulating people by saying words, and the significance of those words isn't given through their objective literal meaning in the language. It's just, it will tend to get you to do things that are the right, behave in the right way. It's a way of controlling your action that doesn't necessarily correlate well to what the literal meanings of the words are. I mean, like, take a yoga class, for example. I mean, when they use lots of words to tell you what to do, but you can't literally push yourself down to the center of the earth or something, whatever they tell you to do. But by hearing that, you start engaging in activities that are what you're supposed to be doing, even though you can't literally carry out the instruction. I don't know much about yoga. I just know that when I did do yoga, I was confronted by, wait, how am I supposed to interpret these sentences? And I realized, just react to them, and then that'll be okay.
Can I also ask, on a more practical point, because you introduced this for technology, it seemed to me that what you're saying in your talk is that we already do use introspection to build artificial systems. It's just that we should stop being embarrassed about it. Is that the take-home message?
Yes, but it's not just that we do it fully and we're embarrassed about it. Because we're embarrassed about it, we do it in really little bits.
Okay.
Like, my favorite example is fuzzy logic. Zadeh was lying on his bed one day, this is from his biography, and he was thinking about stuff, and he came up with the idea that, you know, it's not clear whether he was introspecting or not, but he came up with this idea that concepts have fuzzy edges, which is sort of a nice subjective, wonderful, real-world idea which wouldn't come out in mathematics. I love it. But then he goes back and it puts it into logic and into mathematics and so on, and then eventually we find that it's isomorphic with some statistical system, so it didn't actually contribute to anything. And I say that is because he just took one little shy step into subjectivity. And if we took more steps, if we weren't shy, we would get different results. Because you won't take just one step at a time. We'll take a few steps to create an actual model, and maybe that model will be of use.
Could you give me an example of how that story would have played out if he had?
Oh, I can, but not in the time allotted.
Okay.
You're welcome to my desk, and I'll show you a video of the output of the system. Yeah, but I can send you the PDF of my upcoming.
But with subjectivity, you can't do that, right? You can't have your subjectivity and then the artificial subjectivity and somehow compare the properties of them together. So,
why not? Let me take a group. You can't get hold
of the artificial subjectivity.
Someone writes, and let's look at the expert system, okay, which applies rules in a very rigid way. And I'd say, oh, this system's applying rules, I'm applying rules, and then the system has this output, and I have this output. Why is that? Okay, if one believes that one is an expert and one is applying rules, then they can compare their own way of doing things with the way that the system that they created or someone else created does the same work. So in a sense, they can compare.
But that's just on output.
Yeah. Yes, but we can. What I bring this artificial leather example is I'm saying, let's look at as many aspects of the leather as we practically can, and then let's replicate the parts that are relevant to us or important to us, like the horseless carriage. One of the things we don't have in a horseless carriage is a horse, but we still have the carriage.
The artificial intelligence isn't then the things that are important is not the subjectivity, it's the behavior.
Ultimately. But seeing how the structure, how the internal structure of it works, could be abused. And all I'm saying is that we should stop banning it. In a sense, this whole talk has a really tiny take home, and that is stop being ashamed of using subjectivity. And because it actually makes a lot of sense to use subjectivity. And there's another part that says, which I didn't have time for, is like we are using subjectivity every day we program.
We're over time, so it'll have to be. I mean, if you can ask it in 10 seconds and he can reply in 30 seconds.
I can't speak up.
Okay.
We've had enough conversations.
Thanks, Sam, and thanks everybody for coming, in particular Felix and David, who hadn't been here before, I guess, so thanks for coming. I hope to see you at a future EI as well, but let's thank Sam again.
Thank you.